Nothing in this program should be considered investment advice. It is for educational purposes only. Please hit pause and read this disclaimer in full.
The financialization of Wall Street and their rapacious behavior has been stacking stones in the backpack of each of our citizenry and piling boulders on top of the future generations.
The following is the audio version of a video released at peakprosperity.com. Visit peakprosperity.com to watch the video and to find other insightful content such as articles, discussion forums, and exclusive subscriber-only content.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this episode of Finance U. I'm your host, Dr. Chris Martinson, here again with Paul Kiker of Kiker Wealth Management. Hey, Paul, good to see you again.
Good to see you as well, Chris. Good to see you as well.
Well, we were just, before we hit the record button here, obviously touring the state of the world. Lots of things going on out there that I think they have to be looked at sort of cohesively because, you know, there's markets, and we're here to talk finance and markets. But those themselves are linked to what's going on politically as well as socially. And boy, there's a lot of volatility going on out there across all those dimensions. And so, Paul, today I want to talk about some things. I want to talk about volatility, liquidity, and also silver and gold, obviously. And part of the reason I wanted to do this was last week, a lot of attention on gold and silver and what happened there, right? But it was beyond that because it was copper and platinum and palladium and then oil. And also stocks, but they got rescued pretty quickly, but also currencies. Here's the point. We've been talking about the carry trade. We've been talking about that we have this large system of financialization, which is making money with money, and that these things, like all things do, come to an end. And I'm a little worried that we're going to look back and look at January 26, 2026, as the day that we got our first tremor. Remember 2008, we had tremors. Even it was 2007 was the first tremor, right? Bear Stearns?
Yes. Stearns was actually, February of 2008.
Yeah, February 2008, right? Mm-hmm. But it was pretty far back there. So you get those little tremors, February, and people are like, oh, no. But then it was like, oh, okay, everything's fine. And then you get the next tremor. And then by the time October rolled around, if you had read those signs correctly, you could have obviously avoided a lot of pain, potentially.
You sure could have.
Yes. So I think we're seeing those. I think we're seeing some tremors again. Could be wrong, but I'd like to talk about that. So, what do you see on your end?
No, same thing. I mean, everywhere you're seeing tremors from Japanese yields to, you know, interest rates across the board. What happened in gold and silver? So I was thinking on Sunday, just trying to look big picture. I have a theme for if I could choose a song theme for the year of 2026, it'll be Welcome to the Jungle. Because, I mean, this is a completely different environment to start out the year than what we've seen in a while, especially with leadership in the markets for the month of January. So lots of things to pay very close attention to and be very aware.
Well, let's take a quick tour of the markets because, you know, you and I have been talking about this potential for an AI bubble. Listen, AI is here to stay. I'm not saying AI itself is a bubble, but the way some companies have gone about building this thing out pell-mell in a rush without a good business plan, with no clear sense of how they're going to earn money, has echoes of, you know, Web 1.0 back in the 1990s, late 90s. So, hey, let's take a look here. I'm going to full screen this, so I'm going to drop myself out. This is the total market here, looking across all these different sectors. This is for the past week, Paul. And what are we seeing? Well, obviously, Microsoft got a little bit spanked here, but also Oracle, Palantir, NVIDIA, AVGO, MU, AMD. This looks a whole lot, just this upper left quadrant here, looks a whole lot to me like there might be some trouble in the AI space.
Yes. Yes, AI, software, even cybersecurity index got hammered yesterday.
Really?
So, yes, it did, which is interesting. So, you know, and the question is, can the market continue to run to all-time highs now? We've been consolidating for a while, but can the market continue to run when you look over the past couple of years and really the only leaders have been the top 10? The S&P 490 has basically done nothing since 2023. So we're at a very important inflection point right now.
Interesting. And you mentioned software. This is fascinating to me because I've been reading a lot about, I'm pointing here now, this is software applications, right here, down hard, pretty hard right now. And the reason this is important, because I've been reading a lot about how Anthropic's AI engine called Claude does such an amazing job writing software that you can now just talk to it and it'll write you an app or a spreadsheet function or whatever you want. And so the idea is that we might be, you know, software is actually one of the most valuable products that the United States produces. And so if software as a service, SaaS, software as a service, if SaaS is out, it's early to call it out, but I think we're seeing some early tremors where people are like, we're not so sure how, say, Adobe is going to continue to do what it does over here if people can just get the features and functions they want by speaking into their phone and asking for it. It might be, this is a complete revolution when a doofus like me could basically write code by talking to an AI engine. So that's a pretty big disruption right there, possibly.
That's a huge disruption. And for, you know, look, I'm sure I'm not the only person. I cannot stand a slow computer. So anytime I buy a computer, it's the fastest, most powerful, and I use it for as long as I can. I pay very close attention to software. Well, DEI, we're seeing the impact of that because none of the software that we have to use on the new stuff now is better than what it was 4 or 5 years ago. So if we've got a situation where you can have AI write your software programming, then that's going to be something a lot easier for people to shift into because it's just not as reliable as what it has been in the past. You know, it seems to be degrading with every new upgrade that comes along and higher expenses that you're paying. So it couldn't come at a quicker time if that's the case.
Let me recount this. So Nick, who works with me, is very technically gifted. He's been in tech his whole life. And Aaron, who works with me, is very technically gifted. These are two solid technologists. I'm not a complete doof, but I just get this new computer the other day because one broke. And so it's a new computer. So all I want to do is put Microsoft Office on there because I still use Word and PowerPoint and stuff like that. And we have a seat license. It took the three of us about 2 hours to figure out how to get that done. Because they've made it so hard, right? Because they don't want you to just download 365. They want you to have something that has tendrils into everything you do, right? Oh, no, you don't want that one. You want the one that comes with our AI and our cloud storage. And you have to, like, basically sign a terms and conditions, a T&C that, you know, gives us right to your firstborn children's genetic code. I mean, it's just like this whole thing. I'm like, no, I just want this little thing. And we couldn't figure out how to get that one thing. It kept leading us. It was the most horrifyingly bad user experience. And I'm like, what is Bill doing with his billions besides hanging out with Jeffrey Epstein? I mean, what is, like, this company is putting no effort into trying to create something that's actually useful, right, for their customers. They're creating, right, something that just finds a way to nickel and dime you and weasel you into their corner of the universe. It's very dystopian and frankly, anti-human. It's just so I can't, if Microsoft turns out to be taking a hit on this, I'm like, good, they deserve it. They treated their customers shabbily, and therefore what happens next is appropriate and good.
Correct. They stopped pursuing excellence. Hey, and for the listeners out there, I gotta vouch for Nick and Aaron. Like, it's amazing to me. If you had them helping you and it took you 2 hours to do it, oh, I don't know if I want to upgrade computers or not. The good thing is Nick lives close to me, so I'll be like, Nick, can I buy you dinner a couple of times to come help?
Yeah. It was a real eye-opener. We weren't being clumsy. It wasn't like we looked back and said, oh, here's where we went astray. It was a really bad, bad process, and it involved 2 FAs that had to go here, and then you'd re-authenticate, but then you'd have to go back a screen, and so you'd have to get another 2FA. We tried this, but oh, no, we fell down into the thing where you had to buy their whole universe again. We just wanted this thing. It's up there. You could click on it, but you couldn't quite get to it. You know, it felt like an insurance claim process. They thought, we'll just wear you down until we sheepdog you into buying the thing we want you to buy, which is this thing you don't want, right? Because it's invasive and intrusive and cumbersome, and it's going to make your computer run really slow, right?
Well, they've abused their monopolistic position. And it will be refreshing to see that monopolistic power be lost, quite frankly, if AI is moving into that position.
So two other things to note from this big, big chart here. First off, if we look over here sort of to the right of the screen, I'm starting to see what feels like sector rotation, people rotating hard into consumer defensive, right? Farm equipment. Real interesting looking at big spikes in energy down here, even though oil hasn't really moved anything to speak of. We got all that. And also notice the financials. JP Morgan, of course, probably cleaning up pretty big with that big gold and silver slam. We'll talk about that next. But kind of interesting to watch this map. That's the last week. A week doesn't a year make, but I think I'm starting to detect that there's a rotation away from all things AI and software-ish and over back into things over here, which is the other side. It's maybe too early to say, but worth noting.
Well, I mean, we're seeing it across the major indexes within commodities to emerging markets to international. And the first 10 days of the year and the first month of the year matters a lot. Because by the time you get into November, December of the year, you don't want to have to harvest capital gains and pay them 4 months later if you have to. So big institutions will tend to make these major changes in the first quarter of the year, and especially the first couple of weeks of the year, because you're starting from zero. And I know we talked about it last time, but I still want to share it again just to point out how that rotation has taken place. Is if you just look at the performance to start the year of the major asset classes, you can see that rotation taking place. So what I'm showing here on my screen is January 1st. I'm going back market close of December 31st. So year to date, you can see the S&P is up 0.04 with the sell-off today, because this is a live chart. NASDAQ is down 2. Hang on, I got to move over to look at my colors. I don't memorize them. We've got purple here, which is developed markets. I mean, think Canada, Australia, Europe. I mean, we all know the problems that's going on in Europe, but they're substantially outperforming U.S. equity classes year to date. And in spite of the shellacking that took place in precious metals and commodities in general, that blue line right there is the Goldman Sachs Commodity Index is up 8% for the year. And then, of course, you've got gold up here at 14, and I think I caught everything. I missed one there. But that's important, because that's an indication of where the big money is starting to move. And I think this is a part of these, you know, Microsoft and the generals that have led this market for the past 3 years starting to break down.
Interesting. All right. Well, it was long overdue, so it could happen. Paul, when we come back, I want to talk to you about the gold and silver, great gold and silver slam fest of last week, but it's not what it appears here from the U.S. standpoint. We're going to have to look at this from an international dimension, so as soon as we come back. Today's markets are more volatile than ever. With ongoing economic and geopolitical uncertainty, navigating such environments requires thoughtful, adaptive strategies, not a one-size-fits-all approach. At Peak Financial Investing, our registered investment advisory firm connects clients with experienced wealth managers who focus on active portfolio management. These professionals use evidence-based strategies designed to respond to changing conditions, not outdated formulas, but customized approaches grounded in research, discipline, and risk awareness. We believe in open, informed conversations, including discussing tools like precious metals and diversification as part of a broader financial strategy. Every investor's situation is unique, and our advisors tailor their guidance accordingly. Visit peakfinancialinvesting.com today to schedule your free consultation and explore how proactive management can support your financial goals. I'm Dr. Chris Martinson, proud to work with Peak Financial Investing. And my support reflects my professional views. I encourage you to take control of your financial future by making informed decisions. All right, welcome back, everybody. Paul, I want to turn here. Look, this is gold, silver, platinum, copper even, palladium. They had these huge run-up. This is coming in from November through December, starting at 2026. As you said, gold is still up, but it ran way up here to 55, 5,600 in this huge slam that happened on Friday of last week. And so we saw the same thing for silver, same thing for platinum. Copper, interestingly, took a hit, but seemed to recover back to sort of the $6 line here. Glad to see that for reasons. And then palladium, a highly volatile metal. Now, what's interesting is, as of today, we're recording this on February 4th. So overnight, I watched the rest of the world bought gold, bought it. It starts to get a little weak coming into London here. And then as soon as the U.S. market opens, well, we're selling it. Now, fun fact, we don't have that much gold to sell. But this is what happens in the U.S. market. So somebody in the U.S., and these are paper claims. They're not actually selling physical gold unless they get called on those paper claims. Same thing for silver. Bought all the way up through until the U.S. market's opened here, 8:30, boom, down. So this has just been the pattern for a very long time. This is the paper game. And so when people say, oh, the price of silver is down, it's like, whoa. Are we talking actual silver you can get your hands on? Because that has one price. And then we have this other price, which is set by the paper futures. Now, when, Paul, I could sell you 5,000 contracts of silver.
Mm-hmm.
That would be 2.5 million ounces. Do I have them? No. So I'm selling you something I don't have. Now, if I went on eBay and sold a Lamborghini to you I don't have, there'd be a word for that, wouldn't there?
Oh, fraud? And they would. Well, it depends on where you... We're not quite there in the asset class to get away with that. So for the rest of us, FBI would come down on you very hard.
Yeah, right away. So I just want to be clear that what we're looking at here is not the actual price of silver. It's a price that's been set for decades in this thing called the futures market, where people trade. Often people, by and large, the people doing the trading have no physical interest in taking delivery of gold or silver, nor do they have any to deliver should they get called on the contract. This is all just financialization, just people trading pieces of paper that represent supposedly the underlying. Now, here's why I have a problem with this. So, Paul, let's imagine I opened up a futures trading system for Ford F-150 trucks. And we say, hey, sorry, Ford, but your F-150 trucks are only worth $38,000. Look, there's futures trading over here with all these people who don't actually have F-150s or can't take delivery or deliver them. But they've decided by trading pieces of paper that Ford F-150s are worth $38,000. Sorry, you're going to have to sell it for that because that's the price. That's literally the silver market in the U.S. and the gold market.
It is. And unfortunately, what the East is buying, right, the physical that they're getting their hands on is going to go East, and it may be unobtainium, as you've talked about in the past. You know, you're not going to be able to afford to buy that back, and that is weakening us from a long-term perspective because it's obvious at this point that we need it industrially, militarily, and from a technology point of view.
Yeah, there's some interesting developments on that front, but before we get there, okay, so this is the paper, what I have here, these are charts of gold futures and silver futures, and apparently the United States just sells these things hand over fist. Now, why? You and I have talked about this before, but it's important to dredge this back up. In 1973, when gold was first going to be legalized again, because it was made illegal from 1933 to 1973, somewhere in December of 1973, it was legal again for private citizens in the United States to buy gold. It was always legal for the institutions and the banks and the government, but became legal for citizens. So they were concerned about, like, gosh, what would this mean? What if the price of gold started rising rapidly? They didn't want that because Nixon had just taken us off the gold standard. They didn't want the dollar to look weak by comparison. So they're like, gosh, what do we do? So they came up with this idea and they said, oh, we're going to start futures trading, paper trading in gold. And they said here, quote, to the dealers' expectations, the dealers would be the major bullion banks, to the dealers' expectations will be the formation of a sizable gold futures market. Each of the dealers expressed the belief that the futures market would be of significant proportion and physical trading would be minuscule by comparison. Also expressed was the expectation that large volume futures dealing would create a highly volatile market. In turn, the volatile price movements would diminish the initial demand for physical holding and most likely negate long-term hoarding by U.S. citizens, end quote. Well, they spelled it out. Dude, if somebody says they're going to do something, then it happens. Maybe they did it. So the futures trading was designed at the outset specifically to instill large volatility to diminish your and my willingness to hoard gold. I don't know why when I buy it, it's hoarding, and when the banks have it, it's investing. I haven't figured that one out yet, right? But that's what this is. That's what this is right here. That's what those slams are. This is volatility instilled in the paper market to make sure that you and everybody listening to this and me have a diminished appetite for gold. I mean, they told us they were going to do it, and they did it. It's important to understand that the structure of the game, so you don't get like shaken out of your positions. You got to hold your positions when you think you're on the right track.
That's right. That's right. I mean, really, in hindsight, the easy part was buying when the prices were a lot lower. It's a lot harder where we are right now. And we've talked about the fact there's going to be some gut-wrenching volatility that comes. Mm-hmm. But the most interesting aspect of that order that they put together back then is that volatility does work for retail. Like, this is my 28th year of working with the average investor. And massive volatility like that, or long periods of sideways movement, the traditional investor just becomes impatient. They do, right? Like, if they're not getting some instant gratification within the first 3 years, they'll throw out a phenomenal strategy to go chase the herd of what's taking place. So they understood when they implemented this at the time, the psychology behind what they're doing to stack the odds in favor of them and the institutions against the average investor. And that's one thing I cannot stand about Wall Street. I mean, it just feels like I'm swimming in poo a large majority of the time because of what takes place in our industry and how they want to capitalize on the lack of knowledge that the average investor has.
Yeah, and they have sophisticated tools now to nudge, herd, sheepdog, harass people into, you know, the directions they want. And I watch this all the time, Paul. So if you look at how gold has been talked about for decades in the financial press, barbarous relic, it's this dead asset, and it's this pet rock, it's all this denigrating stuff, right? You know, and whenever it goes up a little bit, they always run the articles like, look at all these smart people turning in, you know, grandma's wedding rings, you know, or whatever, right? Like smart people sell their gold, you know, and that's what they tell us. I guarantee you the private clients at JP Morgan are getting a very different story about the importance of gold at this point in time.
They are. I mean, what was it? Bank of America and several others came out here within the past 6 months and said that you need to have somewhere between 10-20% exposure to precious metals in your portfolio. Mm-hmm. And that's not working its way down to the average individual. I made some calls last week, you know, after the correction on Friday to some of my traditional advisor friends that are in the modern portfolio theory space. And I'm like, so what do you think about this gold correction? It's not even on their radar. They're not even paying attention to it. They're like, I don't know about that, but crypto looks really good right now. We're going to buy it. It's getting ready to take off again. You know, they're still pushing the crypto space. And I'm like, do you even have any clients that are calling you about metals? Well, I got a few crazy people that are calling me. It's kind of one of them was the exact term that was stated. And I'm like, he's kind of like you. He's a little on the edges, right? And I'm like, well, it's been good for us. So, but yeah. they still, if it's at the top, it's for their elite clients. It's not working its way down to the average individual that's the largest majority of the clientele that they're supposed to be working with. It's at the ultra high net worth level where they're directing them from what I'm reading in research reports.
You understand that process better than I do, I'm sure, which is that if Wall Street wants something, they want to make sure that they can get it to their preferred clients because they make the most money off of them before everybody else sort of figures it out. So let's say they discover that gherkin pickles cure cancer, right? They're going to do everything they can to make sure that their clients have cornered the market on those things before anybody else gets a word about that, right? And then when it finally comes out, you and I will be bidding $10,000 for a little jar of pickles or something, right? That's the game. I feel like what they're doing with their volatility is trying to scare everybody out of gold and silver so that they can get their prime clients loaded up on it. But maybe that's too jaded. But I've seen them do this on almost every thing they do. It's kind of who they are.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, I don't think it's too jaded because that's one of the things that's so frustrated me of being in the industry over all these years. You know, and especially to begin with, and I don't know, right? This is just my estimation of what I'm seeing taking place. I have stated and felt that crypto was the release valve or relief valve, as you said. It was to take the attention from the retail investor over to this really sexy, shiny thing. Like, I mean, I've got some really sexy flies that work really good on the right day for fly fishing. It'll pull them when they're not biting anything else. So retail has been moving in that direction, but you've had this massive demand that's just been consistent and persistent in the precious metal space. well, what's different? Why did we all of a sudden get this volatility? And I'm still working through this idea, but guess what? Crypto's been a terrible asset class to own really since the last quarter of last year. It's down substantially. We're breaking pretty major support levels there. So that's not as shiny an object as it was before. So now all of a sudden you have this massive volatility that makes me feel better about the long-term picture, quite frankly. I was really nervous about the price moves. But it makes me feel better because I understand how volatility works with moves like that. But that now will scare the average retail investor away. If they can just make them pause for a period of time to where they can accumulate some of these sellers or force these individuals that chased at the top that get shaken out in a sell-off like that. And another thing, I've not gone to verify it. I saw a report on it, but I remember looking at the decline last Friday, and I'm like, so where did the circuit breakers go on the CME, right? Like, we're supposed to have a pause in trading if we're down 10% for a period of time. If it happened, I didn't see it.
And, no, there was no pause. And they have what are called dynamic circuit breakers, but it's 10% in an hour. Well, I found an hour where silver went down 18%. No pause. And nothing from the CME to explain why. Did the circuit breakers not work? Did they decide to amend them on the fly? Not a peep. They don't, no transparency, no need to explain why their markets aren't functioning. But this is the important part. I think this is important, very important point. I see this, Paul, and I see a market that's breaking because there's no long-term plan. I'll be surprised if we make it through March deliveries because already February is not a delivery month. Already, like, massive contracts have been delivered in February. So March is going to be a barn burner. And the silver just isn't there, I don't think. And if I'm right, what happens is they're going to have to find a way to figure this out, and they'll probably have to do what the London Metal Exchange did and just break the contracts, right, and tell people, oh, did I say I was going to sell you silver? I'm sorry, we're breaking the contract under whatever terms they make up. Anyway, trust in those markets is already getting shredded. I think we're in danger of losing our ability to actually have a legitimate seat at the world table on these things. And that's terrible because actually markets provide a lot of benefit to a country. I don't think we should be destroying them just so a couple of banks have to report a bad quarter. I think it's a very short-sighted, terrible thing to do.
Yes, and well said. And hey, look, if that price had solved the liquidity crunch and the availability crunch in the short term, I should be able to get it shipped from some of the quickest and most reputable dealers next day. But even if you purchase it right now, I'm being told it's 2 to 3 weeks before they can get it and ship it out. And maybe it's just the volume of what they're dealing with. I think it's, you know, that could be a component of it, but there's some restrictions within the supply network for physical metals that are not easy to gain access to at this moment in time, regardless of what the price has dropped.
Let's be absolutely clear. A market, like a farmer's market, a shop, a market is a place where price and supply and demand come together. And the price is the clearing mechanism so that supply and demand are always matched, right? So it's not a market, Paul. If I have something where, like, well, the price is here. Let me pull it up. The price, Chris, right now on the futures market, $87.50, as at the time I pulled this chart. That's the price of silver. Well, great, I'll buy some for $87.50. They're like, oh no, there isn't any. Well, then it's not a market, right? No. It's such an important point. Mm-hmm. Supply, demand, price. It always has to balance, and if it doesn't, it means it's not a market.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Well said.
All right. So here in the U.S., as of just a few minutes ago this morning, allegedly silver's $87.50. In China, according to Oriental Ghost here, it was $105. That also is not a market. It can't be $85 here and $105 there, right?
No.
It just can't. And by the way, we see the same things. They are hemorrhaging silver out of their vaults. This is 26 tons, 11 tons, just every day, hemorrhaging, going down. Gold here is at 5,100, and in the U.S., allegedly, it's 48-ish. It's just, this is legendary. I just want everybody to know. Like, I have to laugh a little because otherwise I'm it's that Simpsons thing. I'm chuckling in danger, you know? This is what markets that are busy reorganizing, breaking, this is what they look like. They're dysfunctional. The price signals don't make sense. Something's off in this story, you know, and mm-hmm. so that's what I'm seeing.
And that's incentivizing again. My biggest concern is this metal's leaving the West and headed to the East, not to return. And that's incentivizing because, look, if there's only 5 or 10% of the metals market out there that's going to play that arbitrage, if they can get a hold of it here and sell it over there, then that metal's going to incentivize to be shipped to the East. And, you know, I've got it here somewhere. I got sidetracked before we got started. Somebody stopped in the office, and I didn't pull up all these things. But what was it, over the weekend or last Friday, President Xi of China came out and stated that he wanted to see the Chinese yuan as, you know, a position of a global reserve currency. That's a continued march towards a slow and then probably steady replacement of the dollar as a medium of exchange between the governments of the world. So if they're gathering all the metals over there and they're wanting to back the unit, which is their, you know, ideal, the white paper that they're working towards with 40% gold, other commodities and the GDPs of the economies, how are we going to be able to compete with that? Because we don't even know what we have, right? You've got the propaganda out there because they've not audited the Federal Reserve that somebody's trying to say, oh, they're not doing it because we've got a lot more than they say that we do. I don't believe that. Just let us see how much we have and audit our gold holdings in Fort Knox, and let's just have the truth and see where we are. But that's not taking place yet.
And you and I both know why it hasn't taken place, because the audit returns would be embarrassing in some way. If the audit returns were going to be favorable, because it does, listen, you and I could like walk into the Fort Knox and probably over a long weekend and some late nights, we'd pretty much know it was there. I mean, it's not that hard to count stuff, you know? So at any rate, I'm sure somebody's counted it and said, ixnay on the audit day, you know, like we're not going to do that right now. Right. But speaking of that market concept real quick. So I love this. Perth Mint says here, no silver shortage. Paul, no silver shortage. We're working hard to meet demand. And unprecedented bullion demand is resulting in early queue closures. So there's no silver shortage. But it turns out when you go to the site, which I just did, there's literally only two types of bullion, like this little weird little thing. And like there's dusty shelves, and they've got like these two off-brand, like, you know, weird little bars, and that's it. And somebody probably just bought them. They have nothing. Like, they're totally out of product, and they're like, there's no shortage here. These are not the droids you're looking for. And it's just like...
So what are they saying? They just don't have the employment demand, so why do they not have hiring advertisements running all over the place to help them meet the demand if there's no shortage?
There's no shortage, right? There's no shortage. It's just we don't have any to sell at that price.
Right.
You got
price,
that.
Yeah.
And then there's this guy, listen to this guy out of Switzerland.
I spoke yesterday with a trusted person who works for one of the largest bullion dealers in Switzerland. They have zero stock of silver, zero, and they haven't been able to get any for many weeks. They do have silver coming in the door from people who are selling it, but the second it comes in the door, it's instantly sold. So everything which is coming in is being sold. They have nothing in stock. You can't, if you ring them up, you won't be able to get any. As far as gold is concerned, they're out of all the coins, all the small bars, and the only gold they have left are the 250 gram bars, the 500 gram bars, and the 1 kilogram bars. All the small stuff is...
So Switzerland's out. I don't know.
Wow.
I can show you similar things from basically every major bullion dealer all across Europe. And the U.S. all reporting unprecedented demand, very hard to keep it on the shelves. And many of these things have delivery notices out weeks, if not months, at this point in time. So I would have a caution here, Paul, for people, is start to be very selective if you are going to buy gold. Like I've bought a lot of gold and silver over the years. And some, you know, you find a company that has some of the best options out there in terms of price and what you want and all that, that's good. But with this level of volatility, there's a second thing that massive plunge volatility is going to create, Paul. It's going to create a few victims in this story. And my concern is that maybe some smaller shops, and you won't know who, like they could get caught out in a liquidity crunch, right? You know, they've taken an order, and then the price moves so violently by the time they could fill the order, like it gets tricky. So my advice is, do not wire money in to anybody who says, I'll fill this in 2 to 6 weeks, because something could happen in that window.
No, I certainly do not do that. Yeah, you're right. That's a good warning, Chris. I've not dealt with anybody who says that wants to take the money and they'll fill it in 2 to 6 weeks, but I would certainly stop dealing with the institution if that's what they requested.
By the way, this is silver lease rates out of London, and you see it plunge way down here. It's recovered quite a lot, particularly on that slam on Friday. But notice, Paul, it's still worse at the depths of 2022, which was pretty bad, the great financial crisis. Like, it's recovering, but I wouldn't say we're out of the woods yet here on that. So what this is saying for people looking at this, it's the silver lease rate. It's saying that you're gonna, how much do you have to pay per month to lease some silver for a month? And the only reason I'd lease some silver is I gotta deliver some to somebody because I promised it to them. But if I have to pay, call that 3% per month, that's a lot.
That's
on an annualized basis, you know.
That changes the market dynamics dramatically. It really does.
Yeah. So here's what I'm seeing: silver tightness all over the world, way out of whack prices, depending on whether we're in Mumbai or Shanghai or London or wherever. Tokyo, very expensive in Tokyo compared to other places. So you have that, and that'll settle out over time unless something happens like the U.S. declares force majeure or says we can't sell anymore, or, oh my God, it's terrible, China bought all these contracts, promises to deliver silver from us, and we don't feel like giving it to them. Whatever. We'll see how that all plays out, but not out of the woods yet. But I'm a little disappointed that we didn't have our circuit breakers or that the officials regulating the market decided, let's let this just sort of, I'll use this term carefully, abuse people one more time.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you one thing that's been interesting from my perspective is where we stop the decline. And who knows whether, look, Dave Collum's hilarious when he talks about technical analysis and the wizardry of it. You know, it doesn't predict what takes place with the market, but it does help increase your probability of success if you've watched the markets for a long period of time. And I thought this is fascinating because when you finally get this smacking in the metals price, If you haven't had exposure, take advantage of the decline and pick up some. But it still makes sense to just kind of step back and see what takes place. And what I've liked that has occurred over the past couple of days. Now, this is end of day chart, so it's important. I want to watch it end of day just to take out a little bit of the noise. But in sharing my screen with you here, I've got silver spot price. This is just going back for 1 year. You can see we have established resistance now. But notice we came right down to a minor level of support. We had a little bit of bouncing back and forth in December before we launched higher. And technically we're working back and forth in here. And if you look at it on a weekly basis, you know, you've got that 20-week moving average that's down here. But so far, my question is, are we going to establish a level of support here of which we can rebound higher? Now, if we happen to get a massive sell-off in the overall market, this momentum can continue because it scared a few people. Maybe we go back to the July last year kind of consolidation and break off. But technically, you know, I've been pretty impressed with the demand that has stepped in on a daily basis right at this level right here. And we've recharged on a relative strength basis, which is good across the board. So, I mean, I think it's going to, you know, we need some working back and forth and consolidation in this area to build strength for the next move. But I really like what I'm seeing so far. And we're only 3 days into the week, right? This is 3 days into the aftermath of the decline. But I really like what I'm seeing in that supply demand metric in there, because somebody's stepping in and buying at that level of support so far. And after a major decline like this, you know, I would be more worried if we immediately went back to that old high. I want to see some working off of that speculation and euphoria. We've shaken out a lot of the weak hands, I would assume, but you've got some strong buyers that are stepping in at that level of support. And if we're continuing this bull market, which I think we will over the long term, we're going to continue to establish these higher levels of support until at some point in the future, the way that the evidence tells us that it's overdone and it's time to, you know, take your profits and go somewhere else.
Yeah, good point. So on a percentage basis, on a dollar basis, Friday was without equal for silver, right? Obviously. because what was it, like $37 at one point or something? But on a percentage basis, which allows us to compare back to everything, all the way back through U.S. history, silver has never had a one-day percentage decline that large in 275 years of silver history, right? And it had some big moments back there. We had the Hunt brothers in the 80s, you know, we had the Civil War gyrations that happened. There were some big moments, but that was just to reinforce the idea for people that this is not just sort of like interesting or maybe slightly spectacular. This is absolutely unprecedented what we're witnessing right now.
Yes. And
maybe if my charts went back 276 years, we'd find, no, it's like, that's kind of interesting. So, all right, Paul, when we come back, we're going to take a quick break here. When we come back, we got to talk about this, the vault that Trump has just announced, because it plays into all of this. We'll be right back. Hey, folks, Chris Martinson here, and I want to talk to you about having gold and silver in your portfolio and tell you who I personally use and recommend for when you are ready to buy gold, silver, or other precious metals. Now, if you've been paying any attention at all, you know that both gold and silver have been increasing in price dramatically over the past year. Or rather, the dollar has been declining in value. Today, gold is more than $4,000 an ounce, a lot more. Or should we say that a dollar buys less than 1/4,000th of an ounce of gold? I don't know. You know, we could go either way. And I don't know what the right amount of gold and silver you should personally own. That's between you and your financial advisor. But I can tell you that the number is more than zero. Morgan Stanley now believes that number should be 20%. State Street Advisors pegs it between 2 and 10%. Sprott Asset Management believes that a 10 to 15% weighting is correct, while Proactive Advisor Magazine's analysis recently found that up to a 35% weighting outperformed a traditionally balanced portfolio. Okay, so you've decided to pull the trigger and buy some gold and silver. Your next decision is incredibly important. Who to use? For U.S. customers, I strongly recommend American Gold Exchange, or AGE, because I know and trust its founder and president, Dana Samuelson. First, Dana has decades of experience in all things related to precious metals, having founded American Gold Exchange in 1998. Second, American Gold Exchange has an unbelievably stellar 5.0 Trustpilot rating based on 3,744 reviews. Third, I have no trouble believing that because I know Dana personally, and he's as solid and as dependable as they come. Fourth, he'll help you make the right choices and understand the ins and outs, the ups and downs of any particular decision. In times like these in particular, deep experience is the most valuable commodity. By clicking on this link, you'll get both hold of Dana's firm and you'll be helping out Peak Prosperity because we have an affiliate relationship with Dana's firm. Full disclosure, whether you click that link or you just go to AGE directly, you'll receive the same great prices and excellent service. But remember, you should not have a zero weighting to gold and silver. Thanks for listening. Now back to our program. Welcome back, everybody. So, Paul, I'm sure you've heard about this. The Trump administration plans to deploy $12 billion, to create a strategic reserve of rare earth elements, amongst other things, a stockpile that could counter China's ability to use its dominance of these hard-to-process metals as leverage in trade talks. But down here, kind of interesting, I pulled a quote from the article. It said, based on Vance's February 4th proposal, the U.S. plans price floors for certain critical elements via tariffs in a trading block, not direct buying. So I don't know what that means. I don't know how you set a price floor via tariffs. Unclear. I don't know. I'll have to read into that more. I don't quite get that concept.
If I didn't have earphones in, you'd see smoke coming out my ears because I'm trying to figure out what that means, right? If you're not going to have direct buying, you're going to put price floors in there.
But so we just tell everybody?
It's going to be illegal to buy it, you know, to sell if it goes below a price. Didn't Germany do that back during their Weimar Republic? You couldn't sell on a downtick in the German market back then. That's interesting.
Well, maybe we might say like a certain, let's say it is a rare earth element. Let's say we've decided that dysprosium should always be $10,000 a pound or more. So I guess if you tried to sell it for $9,000, we would put tariffs on it to bring it up to $10,000.
That makes sense. Via tariffs, that does make sense via tariffs in a trading block. Yeah. Right. So we're just going to penalize you if you sell it for less than that, and we're going to take the money. So we set a price floor. That's interesting.
Okay.
I'll tell you what's fascinating. I did not see that. Okay. That did not hit my radar. But I watched different sectors, and VanEck has a rare earth metals and rare earth metals ETF. So it's always on my watch list, and it's had some really interesting movement over the past 90 days. It's kind of come to life again. And a lot of that has to do with what's taking place in the commodity space, but it was really strong in its movement. And one thing I've learned, if you watch a price move like that, just kind of out of the blue, yeah, it's related to what's taking place in commodities and the rotations there. But when it's outpacing some of the other sectors, I'm always curious what news unfolds. So there's somebody that understood that was coming and started moving on it. We've seen that several times, you know, under this administration and prior administrations, quite frankly.
Well, unfortunately, there's a lot of insider trading going on. We've seen it over and over again.
That's true.
They just can't stop the leaks. Somebody's out there in the markets doing stuff minutes, yeah, seconds ahead of big moves. We've seen it over and over again. So that's worth keeping an eye on. We'll watch that. I don't think $12 billion is actually all that much. So it's a fraction of the gold market, a fraction of the silver market. I don't know how much it actually gets you. But I will say, I actually think it's a good step in the right direction, because I do believe every nation, and China's doing this because they're smart, I judge. They are buying more copper than they currently need, because it tarnishes a little, but otherwise you can store it in a warehouse. They're storing oil. They're building out larger and larger strategic petroleum reserves and topping them up. Smart thing, right? In case something happens, you'd like to have that in-house, as it were. On and on and on. So I do think that it's important, if you want to be autonomous as a nation, you have to kind of be self-sufficient in most regards, or at least have a buffer to carry you through a period of instability. So I think we should do that. For too long, our nation has just been like, we don't care. Sold our strategic silver stockpile, sold everything. We have no strategic stockpiles. We sold our strategic petroleum reserve, which should have been called the political petroleum reserve, you know, because they day traded that for election returns. But anyway, I do support the idea that we ought to have a deep pantry as a nation.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. And in reality, if you just take it to the most wise outcome, if we're wanting to bring manufacturing back in this country and it's going to take 4 years to bring some of these manufacturing facilities and refining facilities up, then we need 4 years of demand in our savings right now to have independence. Otherwise, we're relying upon other countries and we're in a weak position. And unfortunately, the speculation after leaving the gold standard, the complacency that's happened in our leaders, the weakness that they have in focusing on short-term outcomes has been to financialize everything and try to squeeze as much profit in just-in-time inventory with the arrogance that comes along with that, to think we're above reproach. Nothing's going to happen to us. Nobody can pull the rug out from under us. And unfortunately, that's the position we find ourselves in as a country because of those foolish behaviors in the past. We've spent down all of our emergency reserves and savings. We go back to the Biden administration. They drew down for short-term political benefit our strategic oil reserves. Well, nothing happened in hindsight that caused us to absolutely need those. But why would you put yourself into that foolish of a position to begin with when you've got all of these stresses that are occurring and pops and cracks and tremors that are occurring around the globe? It's just a foolish position to put ourselves in. So that's wise, Chris. I mean, we absolutely should do that. China's doing it. I mean, our competitors are doing it, and that's putting them in a stronger position than us. I mean, you've highlighted several times how much they have increased their energy and utility production capabilities when ours has been flat. That puts them in a stronger position than us, and it increases the quality of life of their citizenry, where the financialization of Wall Street and their rapacious behavior has been stacking stones in the backpack of each of our citizenry and piling boulders on top of the future generations.
Well said. You know, that extends as well to, I don't want to pretend I'm super critic of everything, but I've noticed that like, if we're really going to compete again with China, right? What do I know about car manufacturing? Really nothing. But I can tell you this. The way that the United States manufactures, say, a truck, light vehicle truck, because of NAFTA and rules and stuff and political considerations, it might be that the transmission's made in Canada and the chassis made in Detroit and the final finish happens in Mexico or any combination of those. But anyway, point is that that one truck, thousands of miles of stuff have to be shipped and across borders and logs and kept all that. Meanwhile, the Chinese car company BYD puts raw steel and stuff in one building opening door, and so just down the way, a whole car comes out. You know, so their complete supply chain, manufacturing chain, might be 7 miles long. It's very hard to compete in time, cost, energy, anything, if your supply chain happens to be tens of thousands of miles long, because the part has to go here and go here and then come back and then go there and then come back. It's just very inefficient. So I don't know how we solve that part of the story, that we have a very inefficient processes here because of how we've chunked up the businesses. But two, Paul, if you try and start a business, it's almost like my country here in Massachusetts. They don't want you to start a business because they make it so hard. They make it really hard.
They do.
The this, the that, the laws. I mean, just to take on a single employee is a mountain of paperwork. Because they got to get their unemployment insurance, and there's the disability, and then there's, you know, on and on and on and on and on and on. Right? It's just a huge thing. Whereas in China, it's just like, yeah, let's get it done.
Let's get it done. Let's implement some wisdom and let's get it done.
Yep. All right. So volatility, though, I think it's connected. I think liquidity broke a while ago. So here's currencies today on February 4th. This is a 5-minute chart, but we can clearly see the dollar is sort of like climbing all day today. The euro is down. The yen keeps getting slammed up. A lot of volatility in the yen, by the way, and it keeps drifting lower. So they're having a hard time keeping that up. The Canadian dollar, the Swiss franc, the Australian dollar, the pound, the New Zealand dollar, but also look at Bitcoin here. Not good. And then let's compare that to, these are currencies over a daily chart. So this starts back in November. This is December. This is 2026, February. You can see here that this is where that volume quake happened, and the dollar's spiking hard right here. And we can see especially there was a huge spike in the Japanese yen right then. These would be what I would expect to see, Paul, if the so-called carry trade was unwinding. You would see a lot of volatility in the currencies, particularly there would be a rush for dollars, but maybe also for yen. So that day, the 26th of January, was this spike. It was enormous. Normally, currencies don't move that much, but that was a big day. And so I think we're starting to see here, this is consistent a little bit with the idea that we had a liquidity crisis sort of erupt here towards the end of January. One way to look at it. And the other way to look at that is, to me, Bitcoin has been the ultimate liquidity gauge, not digital gold, not, you know, a way to conveniently store money and carry across borders. It's been a liquidity gauge. And it's been, like you said, 110,000 here in November, down, sort of sideways for a while. But this part right here, this last tail, that's consistent with the liquidity gauge gauging us that there's no liquidity, right? Telling us that story. So I think something snapped. And, you know, they'll paper it over. I'm sure the bat phone was ringing between all the major central banks, swap lines. I just get the sense, you know, they're putting fingers in a dike, you know? Then we'll run out of fingers at some point. I don't know. The carry trade was going to end someday, and when it did, it was going to look like that.
Yeah, very well said. I mean, it obviously looks like that. You know, and then, too, one of the things that's coming to mind right now is Jesse Livermore's book, The Reminiscence of a Stock Operator, has some fascinating information in there. And, you know, and the big picture, he doesn't state this in there.
And that's from the 20s, right? That's like from way back, just so people know. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. Thanks for pointing that out. So Jesse Livermore was a legendary investor to the top side during, you know, leading up to the bubble bursting in 1929, built this massive amount of wealth and then ended up losing it all. Or the large majority of it. But he wrote a book called The Reminiscence of a Stock Operator. And there's some fascinating things in there. So one thing that came to mind is he would have somebody that would come to him and claim to have insider information. So they'd be like, hey, Jesse, you need to buy this stock, you know. So he would just right in front of them start selling the stock. So what he was doing was testing the supply dynamics of the market. So if he sold a bunch of that stock and, you know, in the book, one of the guys goes, what are you doing? I'm telling you to buy this like it's a great tip. And, of course, when he puts pressure on the value of the stock, it just collapses. So he realizes somebody's trying to offload their shares to him. Another circumstance, they come in and they say this stock's going up. He tries to sell some. The price is real firm, and he immediately goes long because there's more buyers out there than sellers. So when we go back to the dollar selling off at the end of January, I believe that that was a big push from some of the big institutions. We did close below that trend line, which is a major trend line break at the end of the month. And then you're going to step back. You know, these sellers may obviously step back because of the forces of this unwind, and you get this nice bounce in the middle. Now, that may, you know, after. It may last 2 months. It may last 6 months. We don't know how long it'll last, but that breach is ridiculously important on where we're going over the longer term. Month charts tend to be, you know, year to 2 year. Weeks tend to be, you know, months, 3 months to 6 months, and daily charts tend to be, you know, days to a couple of weeks. So to me, that's one major key component of where we're going that goes on my board out there. And these bounces may be noise in the interim period.
Let's go back to Bitcoin real quick then on that. Because if we're thinking about that, you know, you push, you test, you see where's it going to go. Another way to think about Bitcoin, and of course, anything I say here today, Paul, is not recommendation for or against any particular
right. Same for me.
Holdings. But I do track MSTR, right? And 20%, it's down 20% this week. So that's MicroStrategy for people who don't know. Michael Saylor runs his company. It's really a Bitcoin holding company with a few residual activities that MicroStrategy pursues bolted on the side. They do have a legitimate business line of in technology, but the bulk of their value is derived from Bitcoin. That stock used to be 450 maybe at the peak. I forget. It was pretty high up. Now it's 130. But at some point, MicroStrategy gets in trouble, and I think their weighted average cost of a Bitcoin is 78,000, they reported recently. And so here we are at 73,000. So as of the time I took this snapshot. So a lot of pressure there. And I don't know, A, how much of the buying pressure of Bitcoin was actually these guys all by themselves, right? I don't know how much, but they were a source. I don't know how significant, but probably reasonably significant because he was throwing billions in per week there for a little while. But it could go the other direction, which is like, you know, they bought more, so the price went up so they could issue more shares. So they bought more, so the price went up, so they could issue more shares. And that's the virtuous circle. There's a vicious cycle that goes the opposite direction, which is, oh, shoot, we have to sell some to raise money. So the price goes down, so we have to raise more money, so we have to sell more. And what goes up this way can also go down that way.
It sure can. Well, and what's interesting is because I had several clients that had came in with large positions in MSTR, and I was watching it every day until we get them out, right? Finally convinced them to take another approach. But the all-time high was north of 525, just slightly north of 525. Yeah. And I'll share that just for the purposes of the fact that you followed up with that, because I do want to talk about something else that I'm watching very closely that's interesting. So what I'm showing here is so this is a five-year chart of MSTR. So at the euphoric peak back there, you can see right here is 525. That's just slightly north of 525. And we've round-tripped all the way back down. But what I wanted to highlight here, going back to Bitcoin, and it's been a while since I've shown this chart. So that green line right there is the NASDAQ, okay? Mm-hmm. And the candlestick charts is Bitcoin. So what we can see is they were moving in tandem. You know, Bitcoin would bottom, NASDAQ would turn. And then starting back in October of last year, after this, what in hindsight is a false breakout or a bull trap, we reversed. And we've broken the lows that go back to April of last year. Now, this sell-off's a little overdone, but it is certainly gaining steam. So the big question is, look, NASDAQ has struggled since October. I mean, it's at the same level that it was back in October of last year. And all of this bouncing back and forth, we've not been able to break out. The question is, does the NASDAQ, with these leaders like Microsoft and the AI theme starting to come apart, catch down to Bitcoin? I don't know, but that's something to pay very, very close attention to if that's a position you have in the portfolio, because this is indicating that you better be ready for defense in spite of what the narrative out there is right now.
Well, again, you know, if we have these multi-trillion dollar companies that are all arrayed around technology or AI in particular, that are beginning to really break down, that's going to have a huge effect on the overall market structure, right? Because of the, what was it, the last count? I forget. We recounted this just a couple months ago. I'll make this up. But it was something like the top 10 companies are like 40% of the entire market cap of the S&P. Just 10 companies. Those are the 10 that are now wobbling and all of that. So you could have otherwise, you could have 490 companies are doing just fine and still see a dramatic decline in the S&P if these other companies shave 20, 30% off of their prices, which...
Oh, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, and a lot of people don't realize this. So it's very important what the majority of the stocks are doing. So I've got it in my conference room computer. I don't have it here. I'm sure I could find it, but for the sake of time, I won't look. The S&P 500 X the top 10, which is the S&P 490, has essentially gone nowhere since 2023. But yet the market has gone up dramatically. So back in 2008, the overall index bottom market didn't reach its bottom until March of 2009. That was the low that occurred. But the average stock in the S&P bottomed in November of 2008. And Tom Dorsey, which is one of the guys that he's retired now, but he helped me to design the strategies that we have, was screaming from the rooftops. He said, we are close to a bottom. We're within 6 months of a bottom because the average stock has bottomed here. Before the breakdown, back in November of 2008, he was screaming, the generals are starting to break down. And that's what we're seeing right now. You know, they on the tariff sell-off last year, pretty much everything broke down, and then Trump backs off. You know, he got the acronym TACO, Trump always chickens out or something like that. Market roars ahead with your AI, but you had in 2025 one of the worst years of performance with your average value stock in comparison to the S&P 500 and growth. Same thing that happened back in 1999 before internet bubble, you know, technology bubble 1.0 burst. So we have all kinds of warnings that are taking place right now. And then this introduction of excess volatility, Japanese yields, it looks like the yen carry trade starting to unwind. I mean, if you're passive and you're not listening to the individuals like us that have been warning as watchmen for quite some time, you have no clue what's taking place. You're absolutely oblivious. And you're very, very close to getting hit in the mouth with a baseball bat. Because the big question is, how can they continue to rescue this, right? If we're failing at this point with the fiscal spending that we're doing right now, is the new Fed chair nominee Warsh going to be able to slam rates? If you go back and look at what his history is, he may change the structure of what's taking place and the Fed's doing within the banking system by deregulating the banking system, which would be good for the average individual, and especially small businesses. I'll talk more about that next week because I'm in a white paper right now that's absolutely fascinating. But I mean, there's a lot of warning signs out there across the board. I mean, there really is. And I don't know how this unfolds, right? They've been able to kick this can down the road for so long, but I can certainly say that I'm on a more defensive stance right now, not acting, but prepared on any little bit of tremors, because if this continues in this volatility, we may wake up and see the S&P and the NASDAQ down 10 or 15% in one day, and I guarantee you that they're going to exercise the circuit breakers when it comes to the overall market.
They'll work perfectly there.
It'll be absolutely frozen, and then, you know, everybody sits back, and then, of course, everybody's going to come out and tell you they're going to save the day somehow. But I'm concerned we're building for that later in the year. And what I'm curious about, and I don't know if this is how it'll unfold, but if we're repeating a larger crisis, I was hoping that we were going to get a 2000 to 2003 kind of decline. I said last year I thought that it was going to be similar to the 2000 top. Absolutely wrong, okay? But we're so close to the end of this speculative rally, that it's okay because we didn't go batten down the hatches with everything in the portfolio. We still participated. I'm just aware of that and paying attention. What I'm curious to see will unfold this year is, do we get this great rebalancing into commodities? And similar to 2008, you've got an S&P by June or July that's had some tremors and is slightly below where it started the year, but commodities are substantially higher. And then that pressure on corporate profits because of that cost input leads to a calamity in the fall. I don't know, but that's kind of what I'm concerned about, the theme taking place this year, especially with the rotation we're seeing earlier in the for the first month of the year.
Yeah. Well, we'll see what happens. I mean, I think the Fed might be a little frozen until Warsh gets in there, assuming he sails through confirmations. He probably will. But there's only, he's just one dude, right? He can set the tone a little bit, but he's one vote. So I'm not, we'll see what he can do. And, you know, there's all this talk on the street. He's going to be hawk. I don't buy that for a second. He's going to be who he needs to be in that role. And, that's a political question. It's a monetary question. It's whatever sort of a question. But he was a fixer during the 08 crisis, right? That was his role. He helped broker the deal when Bear Stearns, you know, collapsed, got taken over at $2 a share by J.P. Morgan. I think they later amended that to 10 under some lawsuits. But they had $29 billion of, like, junk that ended up being the Maiden Lane thing that went over to the Fed's balance sheet where it quietly died on the taxpayer's dime. Right. You know, all that stuff. So that's who he is. Right. He's a fixer. So maybe we need a fixer. Maybe that's, we're getting that part of the story. But we're going to get to that thing, Paul, you and I have been talking about, which is at some point the Fed's going to have to make the same decision that the Bank of Japan is currently making. Do I save my bond market or do I save my currency? Because you can't really do both. You can try and do some fancy stuff. But honestly, what are you going to save? They always save the bond market. They
have to save the bond
market. The bond market.
Because if you don't have capital flowing that'll work its way down to small businesses, then your economy absolutely shuts down. Mm-hmm. Especially as much as the cost of as much as inflation has been, the regulatory costs, the barriers that they've raised for the small business. Now, it's appropriate, so I'll kind of bring it up. And Chris, I actually just about sent you this article this morning if you've not seen it, but Brian Johnson posted it. And I saw it yesterday and put it on my read later list. And I read it for a good hour this morning and read it again. But a guy by the name of Michael Nicoletis and put this tweet out on February 2nd. Everyone's focusing on the right thing or the right thing. But he's talking about why the Warsh nomination, I got to look around my camera here, changes everything and why it should, well, I got to minimize this so I can read it. You readers can see it right now, but I can't. Changes everything and why it should not have surprised anyone. Well, what's fascinating about it is in the article, he goes through and talks about what's taking place with the regulations. And he says a lot of what has happened within our economy has been the Fed has decided that they wanted to, you know, trickle down effect, right? We're going to buy all these bonds. We're going to buy the mortgage backed securities. We're going to put the money in the wealthy and it's going to trickle down through the economy. So what he's saying that Warsh is going to do, if you go back and look at what he's talking about, what Bessin has talked about, what Moran has talked about is, yeah, they care about Wall Street, but they want to get it down to Main Street. So one thing that came to mind is in 2008, what happened during that crisis was all of your small banks got absolutely obliterated. Okay. So they took down the small banks. They set it up to make the big banks bigger. They throw all these regulations under the guise that, hey, these big bad banks put us into this position when it was really Federal Reserve policy that led it up to that. But they've so restricted the system that these banks are required to, you know, they get this liquidity and they essentially hoard it, which helps your larger companies. And if you go back and listen to what Mark Andreessen said about the Biden administration in his meeting wanting to have a few companies that are easier to control, it makes a lot of sense because it's throttled the capital that goes down to small businesses to be able to get started. So I remember I had a business idea back in the year 2000. I go down to the local community bank. I'm like, hey, I want to do this. Can I borrow X amount of dollars? And based on my reputation alone, they loan me the money. Well, you could do that up until 2007, 2008. You go down to one of the local banks now because they're based out of some home office somewhere else that has no vested interest within your community outside of the interest that they can pull off of you. They'll give you money if you don't need it, but it's much harder to get. So you've got this situation where the Federal Reserve is set up to where it's easy for your big Fortune 500 companies to get capital, but it's really hard for your small business. What he's saying that Warsh is going to do along with Moran and Bessent that's in there is, yeah, they want it to be good for the markets, but we've been in a situation to where the cart was in front of the horse. If they deregulate the banking system and change the way they're having to hold their reserves, it frees up capital that's going to be available for the small business, your entrepreneurs within the country, back to how it was when we actually had small community banks. And yeah, that's probably going to cause some problems in the overall market. But that's going to put the horse in front of the cart again, and a small business will be able to go down, borrow money at the local bank at reasonable terms because the banks are incentivized to lend again, hire 10 employees that are going to spend locally, that are going to pay taxes, that'll create that demand going forward. So this is the first take that I have seen of somebody that says, okay, maybe they've really got a good plan in place that they're trying to get there. And his argument is if they do that, interest rates will naturally work their way down instead of this artificial injection. Now, there's all kinds of things that I could think could be a problem with that. If we have a currency crisis because of the hangover effect of all the foolish behavior from the Fed before, that may throw a huge wrench in it. But it's the first real hopeful thing that I've seen come out that maybe these guys are really going to try to get us out of the situation that we're in right now.
Well, you know, it's a hopeful idea, but the trend has to get reversed because we went, I don't know how many small and mid-sized banks we lost in 2008 to 2010 in that window. It was thousands, though. Thousands.
Yeah.
So too big to fail became an ecosystem of even fewer banks, right? Mm-hmm. And so we look at that. And then COVID comes along. Hey, McDonald's can stay open. But sorry, Paul, your little eatery there on the corner, that would be too much of a risk because, you know. So, again, you know, that took out small and mid-sized businesses, the consolidation for the large, right? And so I've seen that happening just in every possible sector, right? We've talked about it with private equity, buying up cement plants and HVAC things and vet services and everything like that. So the trend has been consolidation, right? And big government has been part of that, like bigger government, right? We're going to have Palantir looking at everything and it's going to be blah, blah, blah. So that would be hopeful. But man, I'm going to go all Missouri on this one. I'm going to need to see it. You know, you're going to have to show me because that has not been the trend.
No, it is not.
But that interview with Richard Werner with I first saw him talk about this with Tucker. I didn't know this, but he gave that famous story where Chinese were coming out of the Maoist thing and they go to Japan and like, how did you do this? How'd you get all this? Like, how'd you get out of the post-war period? Why? How do we do this? And they said, small banks. That you need small banks who are there at, like, just what you talked about, handshake, reputation in the local community, because everything sort of starts at the small business level. You need small banks. And because China had consolidated by that time to just a few very large banks, but they don't, you can't do that. You have to, it has to be distributed. I would highly support the idea of moving back to a distributed economy where, you know, there were less burdensome regulations, but also it should be small, right? Small banks.
It should be small banks.
Operating with small footprints.
And they have a vested interest in the local community, and they know the individuals far better outside of just a credit score. So, I mean, the thing is look, if I wanted to go build a ammunition manufacturing plant here locally, there's obviously the long-term potential that's for it. I'm just picking one, probably not a good one to pick. But, you know, there was a time in the past, and most young entrepreneurs don't understand this, in the 90s or the 2000s, you could go present a business plan. You had to have some collateral and a little bit of backing. But the reality is, if the business plan was good enough and you could demonstrate the demand, you didn't have to have all the assets to put up the collateral to get that loan, right? After the elimination of the small local banks, Wall Street has the ability to go get tons of liquidity. But unless you have the assets to be able to go front the money as the collateral against that business opportunity, it's nearly impossible to get it now. Now, private equity came in to try to fill that space, but they did it in the most profitable manner by, you know, further trying to consolidate and monopolize instead of creating one here in this local community and creating one over in this local community, because that was the most profitable way for them to play the game, because they're closer to the liquidity sources and the big money than what the average individual is.
You remember, so Paul, was like, just a while ago, you said you were getting calls from Wall Street and they were like, hey, we're trying to sell Bitcoin and private credit and private equity. Remember that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So here's another rule that sort of ties this all together as we come into a close here, which is that if Wall Street's selling it, I don't want it. Oh, hey, did you see this? Private credit is blowing up. Ares minus 11, Blue Owl minus 10, Apollo minus 7, Blackstone minus 6. You didn't see that coming? Every single time.
Yeah,
Wall Street's selling it.
We started talking about it when they're like, oh, it's $50,000 for you to get in after it was $2.5, $5, $15, $20 million to get in. Yeah. I'm like, okay, yeah, we're at the end of this cycle. I'm comfortable enough, you know, saying that this thing is pretty close to blowing up. And then, you know, Trump wants to open up 401ks for you to get in there. And the only good thing about regulation is it hasn't moved fast enough to be able to keep you from being able to see these starting to unfold. So I'm not a big fan of private equity at all at this point in the cycle. I wouldn't be interested in it. And the sad thing is, if you're in it, good luck getting out of it, because it's not a liquid asset.
That's absolutely right. All right, everybody, we've come to our time for today. If you want to talk to Paul and his amazing team, you better get in line, because they're pretty full, and it's just a lot of success over there, because they take their time with you. So if you want to do that, go to peakfinancialinvesting.com, fill out a simple form. Somebody from Paul's team will get a hold of you within 48 business hours to start the process. And the process is 3 phone calls, right? Introductory phone call, and then a information planning session, and then and finally a recommendation session. That's why they're so busy, because they spend time with everybody. And Paul, everybody I talk to says it's really worth their time. So thank you for doing that for people.
Thank you. It's my honor. And I know I'm on the podcast all the time, guys, and having conversations with Chris, but John Alexander on our team, Dylan Smith, we've got Alex Snellgrove that's on the team now. I'm just so honored to be surrounded with individuals and advisors who get it. We're having conversations. They care about the people that we're meeting. And, you know, and I just thank the Lord for you know, putting us in a position where our strategy is working real well. You know, that's not always going to, every strategy has its strength and weakness. But this is the type of environment where our strategy tends to thrive. No guarantees, obviously. But, you know, the most important thing is you have a team of individuals that care about you, and pray that the Lord grants us the blesses our efforts to help you navigate these volatile times that we're coming through, and be prudent managers of the assets that you've sacrificed throughout your life to accumulate, and manage them in a manner that can help shield you from the inflation, whatever comes in the days ahead, so that we can navigate that prudently. So it's our honor. It's our honor.
I'll close with this anecdote, because it's such a good one. I won't name names because I'm not right, but got a call from somebody who said, hey, Paul called my dad the other day, and he's a little alarmed because he was 15 years with this other company, never got a call once. So he's like, did the police just show up at my door? He was like worried. He's like, God, what is this? And the answer was, well, it's Paul. He was just called to check up on you, see how you're doing, right? And he's like, wow, that's never happened before.
Well, that matters to us. It really does. So, yeah. And that's one of the reasons for you listeners, if you've not gotten into us yet, it does take a while to get on our calendar, because we got to make sure we've got the capacity to be able to, if a client needs us, clients are first, right? They are first. And then once somebody becomes a client, they're a part of the family, and we fight tooth and nail to help them, you know, navigate and make sure that we're available. So it's a little different than what you see. You know, all your advisors you can call, get in next day, right? Mm-hmm. So in our case, you're going to have to wait a little, but I believe that it's worth it, because the information we're taking you through in the planning meeting and the recommendations, and I give a lot of recommendations, it's not appropriate for us to work together yet. The timing's not right. But I've set them on a path that they understand. They understand why they need to do that. They're better informed, reduces a lot of the stress. And when the timing's right, we'll come back together.
Excellent. Well, with that, thanks for listening, everybody. We'll be back next week. Paul, good to see you again. Thanks for your time today.
Oh, it's my honor, Chris. Good to see you as well.
Till next week. Bye, everybody.